Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economy, ladies and gentlemen, thanks you very much. It thanks your spending habits, your willingness to part with a buck, because without you, oh, we ain't nowhere. Also on the broadcast today, a CEO interview, and believe me when I tell you this, that is unlike any other. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday. This one is the 30th of January. Good to have you with us for the podcast, everybody. The economic calendar being what it is, today was GDP Day, gross domestic product, all the goods and all the services we as an economy produced in the fourth quarter of last year. It's a biggie, right up there with the jobs number in the statistical pantheon. So here you go, the actual number, no more waiting. The economy grew just a hair better than 3% at an annualized rate from October to New Year's, 3.2 to be precise. Nifty, right? More evidence the darkest of days are behind us. You dig a little deeper and you'll see where all that growth came from. Us, quite literally. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith breaks it down.
Consumer spending accounted for about 70% of our economic growth last quarter. We spent a lot of money eating out and staying in hotels. Another big area where consumers spent more, shoes and new clothes. Turns out, we spent a lot of money on us last quarter.
One area of strength was services spending, and that would include going to the movies or haircut.
Michelle Meyer is an economist at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. She says, don't hate consumers for making themselves beautiful. The fact we're spending like this is a good sign.
Consumers are starting to feel comfortable spending on a wider range of goods. It's not just things that they need to have.
We may be spending more, but we're not actually earning more. Wages were stagnant last quarter. Ken Goldstein is an economist at the Conference Board.
We are using our credit cards and building up those limits again.
So we were making ourselves beautiful on credit. Part of the reason is that we feel wealthier. Home values have been on the rise, and the stock market made huge gains in 2013. Still, the spending trend worries Dartmouth economist Matthew Slaughter.
If we don't get continued and, in fact, stronger growth in employment and in incomes, there's a limit to how much households can increase their spending prudently.
Slaughter says long-term growth can't hinge on steak dinners and new boots. Other parts of the economy need to start growing so consumers can start earning and saving more. And, of course, spending more. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
You know, you got to be in mobile to be anywhere today, right? Journalism, obviously. Advertising, clearly. Social networks for absolute sure. And that's a big part of the reason that Facebook shares closed up better than 14% today, above $61 a share, on the news that that company has finally cracked the mobile code, as Marketplace's Queenie Kim explains.
When Facebook went public, the money it made off of mobile ads was basically zero. Paul Sweeney is an analyst at Bloomberg Industries.
So it was very unsure as to whether Facebook would be a viable player in the mobile arena. And that was one of the reasons the stock had a very bad IPO.
But yesterday, the company said it booked about $2.6 billion in revenue, a little more than half of which came from mobile advertising. Facebook owns 16% of the mobile ad market. That's way behind Google, which owns 53%, but it's quite a turnaround. Deborah Aho-Williamson is an analyst at eMarketer.
To its credit, Facebook, once it realized that mobile was going to be so important to its future, it did work fast, and it did develop an app that ended up working really well.
And best of all, people started using it. Williamson says Mark Zuckerberg was initially resistant to advertising, but since the IPO, the company has pursued ad dollars aggressively. Facebook now has more than a billion users. But some investors worry the company is losing teens. Brian Weiser's not worried. He's an analyst at Pivotal. He says Facebook is now more than just a hangout.
Facebook has been a utility for consumers and for advertisers alike for a very long time.
He means it's like email or the telephone. It's where we keep our contacts and communicate. And he adds, Facebook owns Instagram, which teens are keen on, at least for now. I'm Queen Akim for Marketplace.
The stock market word of the week, at least for now, volatility. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Janet Yellen takes the oath as chairwoman of the Federal Reserve on Monday. She will officially be in charge starting Saturday morning, though, should the bottom drop out of the global economy in the meanwhile. So that's taken care of. Yellen is right at the top of a recent poll over in the UK of the world's 10 most powerful women in finance. Eight of those women, including Yellen, have combined spectacular career achievement with family and children. That may come as a revelation to one Nigel Farage. He's the head of the fast-growing UK Independence Party, and his views on working mothers have raised some eyebrows over in London's financial center, the City, as it's known. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Nigel Farage should know what he's talking about. He spent more than 20 years working as a broker. Armed with that experience, Farage offered this insight into gender equality in the City.
If a woman who has a client base, has a child, and takes 2 or 3 years off work, she is worth far less to the employer when she comes back than when she went away.
Her clients will have drifted off, he claims. Her contacts will have dwindled. If a female broker has a baby, says Farage, she can kiss goodbye to a lucrative career.
In a fiercely competitive world like the brokerage end of it, that women are disadvantaged if they have children. Now, that is a simple statement of fact.
And he added, this helps explain why female finance workers in Britain earn on average 30% less than men. His comments have caused a storm.
He's talking absolute rubbish.
Louise Cooper, finance worker and mother of two.
You don't get 2 or 3 years off to have a baby. The maximum amount of time you get off is 12 months, and many women choose to take 4, 5 or 6 months.
And she says that's usually much less than so-called gardening leave. That's the time that city workers, having quit their jobs, must stay away from work before they're allowed to join a rival company. Gardening leave in London is usually 6 months to a year.
And yet that does not stop employers hiring men if they have a 6 or 12 month gardening leave. It does not stop employers hiring men who they fear may leave. Nigel Farage, you are talking absolute rubbish.
Other critics say Farage has expressed an outdated mentality, a mindset from the pre-crisis days of testosterone-fueled dealing, when men and male aggression utterly dominated the finance industry, to everyone's cost.
If you look at a lot of the financial scandals that have hit the country involving traders and others, then you see that many of those were men who were behaving very aggressively.
Kirsty Eyre, an employment lawyer with Pinsent Masons, says the city seems chastened. She says Farage is wrong about Britain's financial institutions.
Far from valuing women less than men, they are actively looking to recruit and promote more women.
But the city and Britain as a whole are still far from a nirvana for working mothers. Since 2006, the number of women fired for becoming pregnant has doubled in Britain to more than 60,000 a year. And Nigel Farage has posed a question which has not yet been answered. If the city does value women just as much as men, why does it pay them 30% less? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A lot of times when people want to go to a casino, they take a bus. The casino bus industry, the business of shuttling gamblers to and from, is growing, as is the number of accidents involving those buses. Last month, three of them crashed in 5 days on highways here in Southern California. 3 years ago, in the Bronx, you might remember, in New York, a casino bus flipped over and killed 15 passengers. And yet, it's only a loosely regulated industry, as Ben Bergman reports from KPCC here in Los Angeles.
At the vast San Manuel Indian Casino, east of L.A., gamblers crowd around the roulette table and try their luck at blackjack or one of thousands of slot machines. And if you walk through the smoky haze, you reach an area called the bus lobby. Coaches are lined up, ready to take passengers to nearly 30 stops all over Southern California. The casinos prefer keeping the bus companies at arm's length, casting them off as merely independent operators. Attorney Catherine Harvey Lee doesn't buy it.
I think they are intentionally turning a blind eye to the dangers that these buses create for these customers.
Harvey Lee has represented bus accident victims. She points out that most casinos post their bus schedules online, right there for everyone to see.
And I think that in doing so, you're impliedly endorsing these as a safe way of getting to your casino.
The U.S. Transportation Department has been criticized for not doing enough to keep unsafe buses off the road. But the agency's had limited power since 2005. That's when Congress banned surprise roadside inspections for buses.
Literally, it was something that was stuck in the transportation bill at the last minute, and we didn't see it until it was already in the bill.
That's Stephen Kepler. He's executive director of the Commercial Vehicle Safety Alliance. So who lobbied to stop surprise roadside inspections? It was the American Bus Association. Here's the group spokesman, Dan Ronan.
If you do a bus inspection on the side of the road, the 50 people on the bus have to get off the bus. They don't have restroom facilities. They don't have water. What we believe is that bus inspections need to be done at the location the bus companies are operating out of.
Trouble is, it's difficult to know something as simple as which company is operating which bus. One carrier gets banned, and a couple weeks later, another casino bus pops up with the same owners. They're known in the industry as chameleon carriers. Once again, Catherine Harvey Lee.
The sands are shifting all the time. The buses are continuously being leased to other companies, however it suits them to try to evade regulations, evade inspectors.
If inspectors want to come to a casino, they have to call ahead and ask permission to come on the property. No casino would talk to us, but we did talk to a bus operator, Anthony Wen, who runs 15 trips a day to L.A. area casinos.
Safety is your reputation, so if you're not running a safe bus, the customers won't ride your bus.
Gamblers are so eager to get a seat on one of Wen's packed casino buses that even gray-haired ladies run when they see the driver pulling up. When we asked if they were concerned about safety, they said no. They were much more worried stories like the one you're hearing right now would make the buses go away. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
A lot of schools in Georgia, Florida, North, and South Carolina were closed again today because of the storm that blew through that region a couple of days ago. Roads, though, are starting to thaw, and stuff is slowly getting back to normal. Commentator Beth Tytel lives in Boston, knows a thing or two about snow and snow days, she does, and she is sending her good thoughts and wishes to one particular group in the Southeast, working parents.
Where are the nannies without borders when you need them? For working parents who've already blown through their repertoire of fun things to do with kids when you're stuck inside, and also their patience and vacation days, this winter has been particularly cruel, and it threatens to get worse. In Boston recently, on the same day that school was canceled yet again, an assistant professor at the Harvard Kennedy School unleashed a pro-snow day study. It concluded that snow days don't, in fact, have a negative impact on learning, a finding that threatens to embolden superintendents to err on the side of cancellation. Talk about kicking parents while they're down. Psychologists have yet to name the combination of despair and bitterness a snow day can trigger, but it's not unlike the famous five stages of grief described by psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Based on interviews I've conducted with housebound, would-be working parents, they are stage one, denial. It doesn't look like it's accumulating. The meteorologists are always wrong. If they were going to call a snow day, they would have called it already. Stage two, anger. I stayed home last time. My husband/wife is staying home tomorrow. Let my boss spend the day with a two-year-old and see how easy it is to get work done. When I was a kid, they never canceled school. Stage three, bargaining. If they don't cancel school tomorrow, I promise I will A, chaperone a field trip, B, get off my phone when my son is at bat, C, be better about making sure my kids floss, and not just the morning of the dentist appointment. Stage four, depression. That brown noser in accounting is going to make a play for my job. I'm going to be stuck at home with a toddler and a kindergartner, and they're going to want to go sledding. I am powerless over the hot chocolate and brownies I bought in a pathetic attempt to make the day seem festive. Stage 5, acceptance. My children are going to spend 8 hours playing Madden.
Beth Tytel is a reporter at the Boston Globe. Her latest book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth. Coming up.
You know, when you're a taxi driver, talking to me, boom, we're going to come out and we're going to expand the business.
That is, believe it or not, a corporate CEO, Dove Charney from American Apparel. Straight ahead, but first, yeah, let's do the numbers. Yeah, we do know where the happy music file is. Thank you very much. The Dow Industrials up 0.7% today, 109 points, closed at 15,848. The NASDAQ took back 1.75%, 71 points, finished at 41.23. The S&P 500 advanced 1.1%. That is 19 points, ended things at 17.94. Tech can take a lot of the credit. Facebook, as I said, racked up 14%, and the social media glow rubbed off on Twitter. It picked up nearly 7%. Google got a boost of about 2.5% today from the sale of Motorola's phone business to Lenovo. Rumors that Microsoft might be close to naming a CEO, maybe, perhaps, kind of, sort of, pushed its shares 0.5% higher. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. It's a big day for Mattel. The maker of Barbie and Hot Wheels shares how their last quarter went. Speaking of the stuff we buy, the Commerce Department releases its report on personal income and spending for the month of December. And talk about drama. On this day in 1949, NBC aired the first daytime TV soap opera, These Are My Children. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. ExxonMobil, the world's biggest publicly traded oil company, didn't make quite as much money last quarter as Wall Street had been guessing. Profits down 16%, in fact, in part because it's having trouble finding new reserves to replace its declining production. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
The oil business has never been easy, but it's harder than it used to be.
A lot of the low-hanging fruit with respect to oil production has long ago been picked.
Alan Good is an equity analyst with Morningstar. He says countries like China now have state-run companies to extract their own oil. So companies like Exxon have to search farther away, ending up in the most remote parts of the globe.
Whether it be in Argentina or even West Siberia, there's a lot of opportunity there.
Opportunity, yes, but at a price. For example, Exxon is exploring offshore drilling in the Arctic Ocean.
These are much higher costs than what we've historically had.
New technology is helping. Scott Tinker is the state geologist for Texas.
Fracking has opened up new reserves to all the oil and gas industry.
Fracking has a bad reputation with some environmentalists. But if companies waited to invest in fracking, they've been penalized.
It's more expensive typically if you're late to the game in a particular basin. The price has gone up.
For big oil companies, hydraulic fracking is actually the safe play. Tinker says the deep water drilling is more risky.
Offshore wells cost tremendously more than an onshore hydraulically fractured well, but they produce more.
Despite all these challenges, Exxon has new projects that should come online in the next few years. Its production is expected to increase going forward. Analysts say the oil business will remain profitable, just less so. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
About 2.5 miles from Marketplace Global Headquarters here in downtown L.A., there's an old railroad warehouse. It's huge, a city block square, 7, maybe 8 stories tall, that has been repurposed as a clothing factory. It's a company that proudly makes everything in the United States, says it pays its workers more than minimum wage, but which is probably known more for its billboards than its T-shirts.
The boss will see you now.
American Apparel was founded by and is run by Canadian-born CEO Dove Charney. Charney is no stranger to attention, which is kind of an understatement. He is today's conversation from the corner office. We went down to the warehouse the other day, right at shift change, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Hey,
how are
you?
Nice to meet you.
Welcome.
Thanks for taking the time.
I was just working at home.
You came in just for us?
No, I'll be here all night now.
All right. So tell me, we're in downtown L.A. in a huge manufacturing plant, basically.
This is the, basically we have sellers, marketers, photographers, computer programmers, IT experts, production, product design, scheduling, forecasting, retail development. Everybody works, is connected to this building.
You know, is there a shop floor that we could see?
Yeah.
I just want to get a scale of what's going on.
I'd love you to see it.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is basically a full city block.
Jesus, look at that.
Yeah, this is, this is not our only sewing floor. We have a sewing floor beneath us. We have a sewing floor in the third floor. We have a sewing floor above us. And we also engage in sewing at some other facilities in the
After a quick tour, back upstairs to the corner office. You're coming off a rough couple of years, as you know, is the whole economy, right? You're sort of back-ish. Next couple of years, what are you going to do? Are you going to grow? Are you going to retrench and figure out where your strong points are? What's the plan?
Right now, we're retrenching a little bit because it's unclear what the future of bricks and mortar retail is. So what we're doing is trying to master the operations and the success of the stores we already have. And then we're focusing on our internet experience, trying to explain, bring texture into the screen so people can really feel what they're buying. And we're going to optimize, retrench, polish up, refine the business we have. And then as we're really well exercised, something like, you know, when you're a taxi driver, talking to me, boom, we're going to come out and we're going to expand the business.
How much do you figure the made in Los Angeles, made in USA thing is for you?
I don't think it's very important to the customer. And I'm glad that it's not.
Explain that a little bit, because it's all over your branding. It's all over the building outside.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
It brings flavor, and it should also call attention to the fact that we make the merchandise ourselves, which is very important. I am a free trader. When Ronald Reagan said, Yukon to Yucatan, free trade, I don't believe in borders. I don't believe in the Canadian-U.S. border. I don't believe in other borders. And what goes on in Europe is the future.
Let me ask you sort of a derivative question then. If you don't believe in borders, what about boundaries? Because you're a guy who pushes boundaries every single day, has for
boundaries?
Years.
Boundaries? Oh, no.
Gets in trouble about it sometimes?
Yeah. Well, you got to call my mother now.
Okay. No. I don't have my mother on the phone. But seriously, you're a guy who gets in trouble for his pushing of the boundaries in a lot of different ways.
That's important that certain people do that. I remember when I was in elementary school in the third grade, and one of my teachers said, if every student was like you, the school would fall apart. And I said, well, not every student is like me.
With the acknowledgement that you know, people have been selling stuff with sex forever, can't talk to you without talking about your billboards and your advertising campaigns, which are heavily based on sex, apparently about sex, obviously about young girls. It's an interesting marketing technique.
Well, I don't know, I don't know about the young girls thing, but let's talk about sex. Sex is inextricably linked to fashion and apparel, and it has been and always will be, and our clothing is connected to our sexual expression. So, of course, advertising related to clothing, there's going to be a sexual connection forever, whether it's Calvin Klein, American Apparel, or brands that we haven't even contemplated.
So there's more coming.
There's more coming, and it's natural and it's normal, and it's an expression of human nature.
Do you ever look at one of your billboards and go, whoa, all right, wait, we went too far?
Absolutely.
And then what do?
We put up another one.
So you understand how people will perceive that as arrogant and unaware.
I don't know. I don't see it as arrogant. I see it as free-flowing. Free people make mistakes. If it was kind of straitjacketed and controlled, it wouldn't be like that.
Do you get away with your behavior because you're successful? Do you get to do the things you do because all this stuff sells?
I've been getting away with this since elementary school. I mean, this is, you know, I never said, I mean, the society allows me to be who I am, and
Yeah, but you pay a price for that, right? I mean, there have been sexual harassment lawsuits, the immigration services come in, and you've had to fire 1,600 people. I mean, your professional past is not without serious controversy.
Well,
and yet you're still here, and I wonder if that's because what you have sells.
Well, first of all, what I have does sell. The marketplace is critically important. I can speak to some of these controversies, but I get the idea. I get your point. What I'm trying to tell you is that it's important that every generation there's going to be certain people that push boundaries, and those are my people.
What's your biggest weakness, you personally, as a guy running a 600
million? My biggest weakness is me. I mean, lock me up already. I mean, it's obvious. Put me in a cage. I'll be fine. Okay? You know, I'm my own worst enemy. But what can you do? I was born strange.
Well, Dub Charney, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Was too nuts or what?
That was bar none the most bizarre CEO interview I've ever had. Bar none.
Well, it's Los Angeles, man.
Dead serious, most unusual CEO interview ever. We've got pictures and all the rest online, marketplace.org. This final note today, in which state tax laws and the Super Bowl make a joint appearance. Writing at Forbes.com, a tax lawyer has pointed out that Peyton Manning, who will have played twice in New Jersey this season, will owe the Garden State taxman about $46,844 for the slice of his paycheck that he gets for working there. The catch, of course, is that the loser's check from the game is $46,000 on the nose. So if the Broncos lose, which they won't, Manning would be paying to play. Of course, he makes like $15 million a year, so, you know, that. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.